Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello. Well, we are going to, with this evening's program, we're going to be traveling to Devon, England. Yes, we're going to be having a delightful conversation with Angela Garner, who is an animal bereavement specialist, and she was a nurse professionally previous to starting this work, and she actually founded the National Support Service in the United Kingdom to help people through the grieving process when they have lost their beloved pet. And Angela Garner, I'm just so delighted that you're with me. Your book, When It's Time to Say Goodbye, Preparing for the Transition of Your Beloved Pet. As I look at the book, I'm wondering, is this a picture of you and one of your animals? It's as if you mimic each other, or whoever this photograph was taken of, it's as if you're like two souls that are just in different bodies.
Hello, Donna. Yes, that's actually not me. But it's a very fitting picture because I think it shows like the soul connection somehow that we can have with our beloved pets. You know, they become so close in to our lives. And I think that picture shows it rather beautifully.
Oh, it does. I looked at that and I said, well, you know, those people that match the people with their dogs, you know, the images where they say the dog looks like the person. I mean,
yes.
It's hysterical when you know, I just sit and laugh like crazy every time I see some of those because somebody sent me a bunch of them just recently and I just laughed like crazy. And that's what this looks like. Whoever this photo is of, the dog, I mean, just the way they sit, the positioning of the head, everything. It's like they are clones, but just in different bodies. It's amazing. You wrote this book because you wanted to be able to reach people in a way and manner to let them know, number one, that they're not alone with their grieving, and number two, that it is something that you are going to be able to work with and get through. There are those individuals whose bonds with their animals are stronger than they are with the human beings that are around them. When did you first, because you've been a nurse and you obviously have a great deal of empathy since you were in the healing profession anyway, when did you decide that you were going to become engaged with helping people with their animals?
I believe it was back in about 2001 when I became interested in specializing in pet bereavement support. And having had, you know, number of wastes and strays myself over the years, there have been many bereavements, and I was very aware of the special needs that go with pet loss.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I have been, you know, supporting people who have lost people, but there's something that I understood specifically about the loss of a companion animal that I felt very drawn to do something in this area. And I'm so glad I did, because it's like it needed to be done. There are now many people who offer pet bereavement support, and there is another National Pet Bereavement Support Service that was running for many years before the one I started. But what I found was to support people through the whole process is like a really important area. So the time leading up to losing a pet is fraught with so many uncertainties and fears. That's when they need somebody like to walk alongside them, metaphorically speaking. Mm-hmm. That's what I want the book to do. It's like a friend, someone, somewhere for people to turn to and think, you know, how the hell am I going to get through this part? How am I going to speak to the vet? How can I ask the right questions?
Mm-hmm. And all of that, and we'll be discussing it. I was impressed with the fact that one of the aspects that of real life that is very meaningful to you was when you watched a documentary about American soldiers who had served and had their dog companions, and the grief that they went through because they were separated, fortunately, here in the United States, instead of killing the dogs like they did many years ago. I think it was after the Second World War, there were a lot of dogs that were just euthanized because they said you can't bring them home. And in today's world, that is not the case. That has changed, but it's still a big challenge. And those men and women, but especially the men, because mostly it is men that are working with the dogs, this is something that brings a great deal of comfort to them. Also, in your book, you make a point of saying, I don't use the word owner. I use the term guardian. Why is that significant to you?
Because I don't see that we actually own another being. We wouldn't say, oh, I own my children. They are a being in their own right. And quite a few of us who care for pets actually don't feel comfortable with the word owner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes you need to use it in a practical way. You know, you're phoning the vet and you say, I'm so-and-so's owner, or it's kind of okay. But I really wanted to make a point of the way we view these other species who enhance our lives is really important. I wanted to make a mark about that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very good point. We are caretakers, and that's part of our, a part of our responsibility to be aware that all of the creatures we share this planet with, there needs to be a respect for them and for the place that they have in the overall balance of life itself, which I think is something that sometimes, dependent on a culture, it's very difficult to get to. But just recently, and I will share this, there was a commentary, and it's come up multiple times in Cambodia, where dog meat was on the menu quite frequently. And there is a shift now where millions of dogs that have been drowned or killed in one way or another, they have made a shift, and it's coming from the people themselves. And it is a shift that's going to take a while to totally come in and be acceptable in the culture. But it is something when you hear about Cambodia, because in Asia, there is a much different demeanor regarding animals. And I'm not saying it's good or bad or whatever, but it is different because of how they've had to survive in many instances through various circumstances. So here we are hearing these things, but we're talking about grieving. And I looked at a photo of one of those Cambodian workers picking up one of these animals that was basically being starved to death. And the grief that was in that person's being and the response of the animal, the photographer caught the moment, and there was a recognition between the two. It was extraordinarily powerful to see that image. And when people's pets are dying, there is that grief. And right off the bat in your book, you have a chapter. Your chapter is titled Preparing Your Heart and Mind for Loss. That is tough for people to do, I know, as a counselor.
Yes.
This is something you started off right in the very beginning with. And it was about an elderly dog you had. Tell us your story.
Yes. I'm trying to think which story that was.
You were caring for this elderly dog, and he had skin lumps, and Your vet said, I know you want this dog to live forever, but she's not going to.
Ah, right. Yes, that was the dog, our dog, who we lost last August. And, that was one of many conversations at the vet's. And she, as I looked at the vet, this is when, just before the lockdown, when we could actually go in and see the vet. And I realized that Rufus was coming towards the end of his life. I mean, we hoped for many months more. And she could, she's known me for many years, the vet, and seen me through a lot of pets. And she could see exactly where I was coming from and totally understood. We want them to live forever.
Of course.
And yes, going through the whole process with Rufus was a stark reminder of the uncertainties, the fears, and the deep longing inside that to prevent suffering and to find the right time to say goodbye and let them go. To me, it feels like a matter of honour in respect of the life that they've led and all that they've given us is to find that time to peacefully let them go.
Oh, I agree. And I think that I had some very vivid lessons that I learned because our Scotties, we had Scottish terriers. Each and every one of them had their own unique personality, as any animal lover will talk about, even their hamsters, you know, each has their own personality. And when it came time, I remember having a lot of doubts because I did not have a lot of experience with dogs coming to the end of their life. This is many years ago. And I remember our Scotty letting us know that I'm not going to be around much longer. And I thought, oh, okay, but what do I do? And that's one of the gifts that your book provides when it's time to say goodbye. Because being honest about that and realizing that you don't want the animal to go through suffering any more than necessary. Sometimes I think we're kinder with our animals than we are with people. This is something, and I've seen this with animals, and you need to pay attention. And it is okay to release them. And they're grateful. They are grateful for that release. They are teachers, as far as I'm concerned, in many respects. I learned a lot from my Scottie Terriers and from other animals that I've encountered. There's just this process of communication that goes on. And talking about the closing out of an animal's life, this is a tough conversation for so many people to have. I've seen grown men, 6'5", built by, you know, a tackle on a football team, and, you know, a tackler, and just in tears because they had to put their dogs down or their cat or, you know, whatever the animal was, a horse, it doesn't make any difference. Just breaking down and crying like a baby because this was a part of them. This animal was part of them. So let's talk about how we can discuss this with the vet and what we need to do.
Yes, because this is often a really tricky area because the vets, obviously, they're trying to prolong life because they see that's what the guardians want as far as possible. And yet sometimes we need to really face the fact that we have to ask directly, you know, what is the quality of life that my hamster has, my dog has, you know, what are they feeling like? Can you help me understand it? What do I need to look for? And what I've done in the book is create some very practical activities so that to help people work out what they need to ask the vet to start those open and honest conversations and to begin to face it and to line. It's almost like they're vaccinating themselves against, you know, to get ready for the close of the time of their pet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's really important to be able to think clearly during this time. And that's one of the very difficult things to do.
It is.
Because our emotions make us, you know, we're all confused. We can't think straight. There might be a lot of information coming from your veterinary practitioner. You're feeling the whole shattering effect of grief before the loss because you know it's coming. And so that's why in the book I've done some very clear-cut processes for people to follow and adapt and amend, you know, to suit their situation to help them keep a clear mind because the animal needs it. It needs their guardian to be able to think for them and to hold the space.
Yes. And when we think in today's world, it used to be we were, for many of us around the world, we were an agrarian society. Since World War II, there is less and less of that. Actually, going back, I think, to about 1920 to 1940, there was this mass migration. So a lot of people became disassociated from integrating and working with animals and understanding and be able to read things clearly. And I think that's one of the reasons why James Herriot's books about being a vet were so, so significant, because he had to deal with this as a vet and had to deal with all kinds of animals, cows and sheep and pigs and dogs and cats and hamsters and birds and all kinds of things. And people go, wow, this, you know, this is something that a vet has to deal with every day. And we often in the public outside of that environment, we have a very difficult time looking at death. It's almost as if it's something that we don't want to have approach in our lives. And of course, it's going to touch us one way or the other. You also have a very good section in here on advising a family. And the adults in the family may be aware that an animal is going to need to be euthanized, released from its suffering, its condition, yeah. And you have children. And this is something that's part of their learning, and they may or may not react in a way that you would expect. But talking to them about this factor that may have to be done is very, very important because it is part of what they're going to need to deal with as adults. And you address this in the book. And I love your illustrations here. Whoever did the illustration of the little hamster, you know, that's in here, the bunny rabbits. Did you do artwork? Who did the artwork? It's just charming.
Oh, that's my own artwork, Donna. Yes.
Well, it's just absolutely delightful. And you talk about the grief process beginning before the actual loss. That is true. That is very true. And that is something I've seen people cry when they know that their pet isn't to be with them for very much longer. And they will delay in making a decision that is for the well-being of, and I say well-being, that allows that animal to not go through extreme suffering as they will. If you say, well, I want them to die at home, they can die at home. If you have a vet, you know, they can come to the house. But this is something that you really address very, very well. In fact, you have the illustration of identifying free-floating fears. What did you mean by free-floating fears? And one of the questions, what am I frightened about? These are important questions to ask.
Yes, because what happens is when you're facing an unknown situation, and you don't want to happen, you don't want to lose your pet, that it brings up all these different fears. And the sort of fears that arise in the early hours of the morning when you can't sleep and it goes round and round in your head. And the thing is, if you don't actually look at those and identify them, they're just there as background, niggling away worries. And it's better to, I believe, to actually identify what they are, work out if anything can actually be done about them. And it might mean, right, I'm worried about one aspect. I need to ask my vet about it, because they're the person who will be able to explain what will happen. Perhaps somebody's really worried about the process of euthanasia. So it's to do with sort of like looking, in a way, looking fear in the eye, recognizing it, and then it reduces its potency and it allows the person to actually really think more clearly and be more settled and peaceful in their own mind, which is what they need.
Yes.
It's such a disharmonious time that what they need is as much calming down and settlement of different worries and fears, which will benefit them and also benefit their pet as well, because their human will be much more on the case mm-hmm. and listening to them. Yeah.
Absolutely true. Now, you deal with something that I've not had anyone bring up before, and that is disposing of the pet remains, and every country, every environment might have its own protocols for this. And you talk about people that have farm animals, what they need to be aware of relative to having an animal euthanized, and also disposing of the body. And it's not always clear and straightforward when you do that for an animal. As humans, we have our protocols in place.
Yes.
With, you know, we have cremation, and then you can have a burial plot, or however we are going to deal with that. But often with animals, depending on where you are, that may not be so clearly defined. This is important to research, isn't it?
Yes. Ideally, if you know your pet's coming to the end of the life, then the more you can get in place and think about beforehand, hard as it is, the more your wishes will be met and there won't be last-minute decisions made that can be regretted a bit further down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if somebody lives in rented accommodation in the United Kingdom and then, you know, they assume that they'll be able to bury their pet cat after it's died in the garden, it's actually they can't do that because they do not own the land. So they'll need to think of something different, you know, perhaps an individual creation. But if it's all left to the last minute, then yes, snap decisions are made, and you know, it's more difficult to think when you're really distraught after losing a pet, actually mm-hmm. what you really want. So it's all about trying, where possible, to plan ahead and have as much in place as possible. Gently and kindly to oneself, step by step, not mm-hmm. trying to do it all at once.
Mm-hmm. And often,
it is very...
Yeah, excuse me, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is very difficult to think about these things.
Yes. That is true.
Yes.
You talk about yes. owners and or guardians, as you like to call it, having guilt that they maybe didn't do enough, or they didn't give their animal maybe the right food. If they had given them enough vitamins, would that have made a difference? And that all of these different feelings go through people dependent on the relationship with the pet that they love so much. And it is something that is quite quite significant. You also have a section on self-care.
Yes.
And this is very important. Anytime we're a guardian of someone, whether it is human or animal, we always need to remember that we have to take care of ourselves. But you also deal with the practicality, too, that people need to be aware of, and that is to understand that when your animal gets older, it's going to have health challenges, and you are going to have expenses. And I've known a number of senior citizens that will go without food so that they can take care of their beloved companion. And this is something that concerns people when they become aware of that. And I know here in the States, we often have groups that will say, well, you let us know and we'll make sure that your dog, your pet, or whatever, you know, animal you have as a pet is given enough food, because they realize that these people many times don't have an abundance of money as senior citizens. So we really have a lot of things relative to our beloved companions that we have to deal with. Now, what is one of the most profound stories for you that in the work that you've been doing, dealing with people that have grieved, what is one story that comes to your mind that makes you really just so glad to be doing the work you're doing?
Yes. Sorry, the sound cut out slightly at the end there, Donna, but...
Oh, that's okay. Do you want me to repeat the question?
Whole area about... yes, please. It was the end bit. I know you were talking about, like, the financial resources being really stretched, and, you know, the aspect of self-care. So, yes, please do.
Yes. My next question was, what is, in your experience, one of your most meaningful experiences that you have had in doing your work and working with people that you can bring to mind, that you can share with my audience about the grieving process and helping someone through it and the way they resolved that grief?
Right. That's a big question. And I'm going to go back many years when I had the first person who came to me before her pet was actually at the end of her life. And I was very impressed by the way she was preparing everything. And because generally I was finding people were coming to me after the death of their pet, completely distraught, of course. And this particular person, she had a wonderful relationship with her cat, and her care for the cat extended to thinking everything through, even to including where her beloved pet would be buried afterwards, and making sure when the time came she would get as far as possible the vet she wanted and trusted. And so I saw that was the first person who I supported the journey all the way through. And after the cat had died, she came to me for support still, but there were so many things that she had settled and sorted that she could focus on her grief, purely focus on the grief, because there weren't all the loose ends and the, you know, she wasn't overwhelmed by so many things to sort out that she hadn't thought of. She had planned. And after that, I honed the pet bereavement support service that I was doing at the time to preparing for pet loss, to actually seeing people through the whole process. And that was a significant time.
Mm-hmm. And you have a delightful story in here about a woman who had a friend who had a greyhound. It was an elderly gentleman, and that dog died, and this woman ended up knitting a greyhound in such a way, because she knew this gentleman very well, knew the greyhound very well, and she wanted to give him something that would be comforting. And she gave him that greyhound that she had knitted, put it on a pillow in the same kind of positioning that that dog had often assumed, and she gave that as a gift to this gentleman. And I thought, what a marvelous way to give that essence of love and respect for someone that had had a companion for so many years, and that companion was gone, and to do that. And what was funny is she said she had put the dog on the pillow, the knitted dog, and she goes and she leaves the house, and she said, oh, I'm thinking about this, that, or the other. And she said, why, my goodness, that's a knitted greyhound. That's not a real dog. I'm having all of these concerns and these feelings like I would if it was my dog and I'm, you know, I was leaving it at home. So, you know, you have these charming stories that are in your book, When It's Time to Say Goodbye, Preparing for the Transition of Your Beloved Pet. Angela Garner, and the art. I just love your artwork. I think that you capture the essence of the animals that you are drawing, and it's just absolutely wonderful to see these sweet faces of the cats, the dogs, the horses, all the little hamsters, the birds. I mean, you've just done a beautiful job at illustrating. I want to thank you so much for being with me. Now, you have a website, and people can go to that website. It's petlosspress.com. Petlosspress.com, and they'll find out more about your work. And my goodness, I just think that you're doing something so wonderful, and what an inspiration it is for people, because this is something we do have to deal with these beloved companions that we choose to bring into our lives.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you
for asking me about the book and the journey, Donna.
It's a joy. It is a joy. I know how important these things are, having experienced it more than once myself. So again, thank you for being my guest, and I wish you nothing but continued success.
Thank you, Donna.
This is Donna Sebo, and we are going to be taking a break. Stay with me, please. And when we come back, I've got more good things to share. Now, I do need to let you know, I am not in studio where you can call in. Yes, this lady is on the road, and I will be back in studio in a few days, and I will let you know about that. But in the interim, the show goes on. Stay with me, please. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio, able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m., for current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebo'sClassics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. We have a wonderful lineup, and hey, tomorrow is St. Patty's Day, and we are going to be talking with Fabiana Fodevilla, Where Wonder Lives. She is in Argentina. I just love what we're able to do with technology today. And also, we are going to be talking with, on Warriors for Peace, which is from 7 to 8, as you know, Amelia Pang, who was is an undercover journalist that went to China. She is an amazing young woman, and she represents what I feel is the positive side of journalism. So we are going to be having a conversation with her that I think is going to give you an inside view of what is happening in China, and also about the products that we are receiving here in the United States from that country. So it is a powerful St. Patty's Day, both with Warriors for Peace and the Donna Sebo Show. So we are coming up also with not just those publications and shows. We're going to be talking about Romancing the Birds and Dinosaurs. Yes, we're going to be talking about archaeology, discoveries about that. Then the Irrational Fear Cure. And then Magic and Mystery of Dreams and Life's Insights of a man that I honestly didn't know anything about, profound individual, Joseph Chilton Pierce, and so much more. Yes, we're even going to be traveling to France this month via the marvels of technology. Argentina, Scotland, France, England. You know, it's wonderful to be aware of all these people. And if nothing else, it makes you cognizant of the fact that we are part of a humongous human family. And no matter what culture we come from, we basically have the same needs. And the more we can share, have conversation with each other, the more quickly the barriers and the walls and the fears, the superstitions, the ignorance of what so often is promoted comes down. It comes down. It will go away. Well, let's say a good percentage of it. But it takes our willingness to be open and to be interested and to also be alert to the fact that there are many things we can do better in life, not just for ourselves, but also for the planet that we live on. And there's well over 7 billion of us. I think we could do a pretty good job within a very short period of time if we work together. What do you think? Well, I wanted to share a delightful story with you. We're going to be featuring animals pretty much during this program because of what we were just discussing with Angela. But a hamster. Now, those little bitty creatures, you would not think that there would be a big connection with those little bitty animals. But you know, there really is. And there is a woman by the name of Ruby Hanna. She is in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and she's a teacher. And I wanted to share her story with you because it shows the significance of animals in the lives of children, and how it affects us as well as adults. Now, she was in a sixth grade classroom. She had been newly assigned to this classroom, and it was just absolutely miserable. The classroom, she couldn't get the kids together, and she said it just was a madhouse. Every day I came in to this madhouse. Well, what had partially caused this was that students had been reassigned to different environments of schools. She said there were inner city children from a new housing development that were being bused into her school for the first time. There was all this chaos that had been actually created by adults, to be perfectly blunt. And she said the behavior on the playground was just unbelievable. There was bullying, there was kicking. She was constantly working with trying to keep peace, getting the kids' attention. She said, whether it was inside the classroom, outside the classroom, it didn't make any difference. She said, some of these kids in sixth grade, she said they were carrying knives, they were threatening, and she said it just was unbelievable. And sometimes she just felt so overwhelmed, she didn't know what to do. She said, I'm a teacher. I'm not, a coordinator or an organizer for violent behavior. This is not my thing. And she said this school year that she had been in was like a war zone. So she was beside herself. And there was a faculty that was trying its best to deal with this, but they hadn't dealt with this before. This was a whole new environment. But she said she just would go into deep meditation and say, please, I need an answer here. This has got to change. I just don't know how we can balance this out. It occurred on one day. She said it was hard for her to recognize the miracle when it first happened, but she saw something that gave her the answer she was seeking, and it came through one of her students named Teddy. She said he was a very quiet child, very sensitive, covered in freckles, and Teddy brought his hamster to school. Now, think about this. In most schools, the animals were not allowed. Little Teddy managed to bring his hamster to school, and the name of the hamster was Wee Boy, and it was a blonde hamster. She said she looked at this little thing, because they're rodents. Its little nose was twitching. It had these great big eyes. She said, Teddy, would you talk to the class about the hamster that you have? And she said, all of a sudden, everybody got quiet. Teddy, sort of soft-spoken at the beginning, but he got a little braver, and he was encouraged by Ruby to speak a little louder, and he talked about his hamster. She said the whole room became quiet. Nobody was fighting. They were all listening. They wanted to know about the hamster. So she made a suggestion. She said, Teddy, instead of you're holding the hamster all the time, why don't we sit down on the floor? Let's push the desks back, sit down on the floor so that the hamster has a place that it can roam around in. And Teddy even let the kids, after he talked about his hamster, handle his little wee boy. And she watched the children's faces. She kept an eye out for anything that could possibly harm the hamster, but that wasn't the case. Each and every one of the children were so fascinated with the hamster and to hold it. She said, I had my answer. And she said, here's this little tiny hamster. And the arms and the hands of sixth graders, most of them had never, ever had a pet. Well, she got busy. After school let out, the change in her classroom was wonderful. After school let out, she went off to the local pet store. The next morning, she arrives at school. She had six hamsters in shiny red cages. What she did, because she had cupboards in her classroom, she put them up on the cupboard walls and placed them around them, pictures, and she'd even picked up books about the care and feeding of hamsters. And when her students came into the classroom, they spied it immediately, and they were absolutely enthralled. And they were all clustered around the six hamsters that were in the classroom. And what she started doing on a daily basis was forming all the students in a circle on the floor. And she gave it the title, A Magic Circle.
And this would enable the students to become acquainted with the pets. The students voted on the names for the pets. And the names they came up with Mandika, Warrior, Cuddles, Sammy, and Blondie. And this was wonderful. And the names were put on the cages. And during the weeks that followed in school, the students were reading up on anything and everything they could get regarding hamsters, how to keep the cages clean, illnesses that they could get. I mean, there were regular conversations, and these kids started getting to school early in the morning. Yes, early in the morning, because they wanted to talk with the hamsters. At the end of the school day, they didn't want to leave the classroom. They wanted to have more time with the animals. And something started happening that was really very interesting to her. The children, on their own, were paying more attention to their cleanliness and how they were dressing. One of the things that she found that the students wanted to do was to wear, especially the boys, wear shirts with deep front pockets so that they could put a sleeping hamster inside of them. And they were very gentle with the hamsters. And there was an unspoken rule. Nobody harms the hamsters. And you know what? A number of the kids convinced their parents to even get them a hamster so they could have one at home. And Teddy, the shy boy that had brought his pet hamster, Wee Boy, decided he wanted his hamster to be in with the other hamsters. So he brings his hamster in as a cage for the hamster. And one morning they come into class and they found out that Wee Boy was not a Wee Boy. He was a Wee Girl. There were 9 babies. Everybody was shocked. And the librarian that the kids would go to check out books, she ended up having 32 requests for books on reproduction. They had questions and discussions. And of course, once the babies were old enough, she, the teacher, Ruby, released them from their cages, and they would go from one student to the other. And the kids were just having a great time. That initial beginning with Teddy and his little hamster, the results that were coming from that, other teachers started adopting the Magic Circle program as well, and they started using the Magic Circle meeting to solve problems that were occurring out in the playground area. And you know what? Because the children were starting to speak up and speak out, they were finding out a lot of what was behind what was going on in the lives of the children that they were taking care of. But it was used for creativity, too. And she said, we found students that wouldn't even talk were opening up. This all began because of a little boy, a young boy, bringing in his pet hamster. She said it changed everything in the school. And she said, you know what was so wonderful? It started the entire environment of that classroom on a journey, she said, from hate and fear to love and friendship. Ruby says a tiny hamster breathed on our cheeks and left her paw prints on our hearts. I think that that gives such a deep, deep relationship of understanding how we can make such a difference in a way just by paying attention, by paying attention. Donna Sebo here. Yes, I am on the road, so I'm not going to be able to take any calls. But this hour is focused primarily on animals. And I wanted to share something with you. I know that people will say, gee, Donna, because you're psychic, you have certain experiences. Well, that's true, but we're all psychic. Everybody is. And I love my work. I really love my interaction with people. But one of the additional gifts that I've been able to experience is an awareness with animals. And I had one powerful experience that I wanted to share with you. It was with a German Shepherd. This dog, his name was Baron. Baron was as big as a small horse. I mean, this German Shepherd was huge. I had never, ever been around a dog that big. Smaller animals I had been around, and I was comfortable with that. But Baron was something else. I mean, he was just massive. And he had this bark that was so deep and so powerful that it would make anybody just stop in their tracks. Well, when we moved into our home, we had a Scottish Terrier at the time, and Baron and our dog Smokey, Mr. Smokey, I always called him Mr. Smoke most of the time, and Mr. Smoke and Baron had, well, you might say a little bit of a tenuous agreement. We didn't have a fence around our yard at that time. And the family that owned Baron, they were, without our being aware of it, in a very, very deep emotional pit. Well, they were neighbors of ours for a couple of years, and we knew something was going on towards the end of their time in living in that house because of what we were seeing. But I was noticing Baron. Baron was not looking good. This was a magnificent dog. And he intimidated me. I'm not going to tell you he didn't. He did. He intimidated me big time. But for some reason, he bonded with me. I don't know why. I never fed him anything. I never did anything. Well, sadly, one day I had a knock on my front door, and the neighbor's wife came over. She said, "I'm going to be away from home, and would you feed Baron and give him water?" And I looked at her, and I said, "You want me to feed Baron and give him water?" She said, "Oh, yes. You can go in through the door on the side of the garage." And she said, "He likes you." I thought to myself, "He does? Really? Okay." Well, what I found when I went to give Baron his water, and I was just very young at the time and did not understand what was going on, and I had not had any experience with big animals like this. And I can remember opening that garage door, and just his size was just, he was bigger than me. And I just went, "Oh boy, okay." And he would talk to me. He would bark, but it would be a different tone. And I looked at him, and I became very, very sad. Baron was not being taken care of. It was about 6 months later that we learned that the family had broken up. They had had two other dogs, and those dogs had disappeared. But nobody knew what happened to them. They were smaller dogs that Baron was very protective of, and they were gone. And some people said they thought that the family was just in such disruption that the animals somehow were killed by actions on their part that should not have happened. But regardless, Baron was still around. And I looked at him and I noticed many of his teeth were gone. He was just there. It was very depressing to look at this dog. And I would talk to him. And then one afternoon, I was out in my backyard and he came up to me. And again, I was overwhelmed. Because this dog, when he lifted his head was right underneath my chin. I mean, he was big. And I put my hands out. This dog reeked. He smelled. He hadn't been cleaned. He was filthy. He put his head in my hands. And as I was holding his head, I just looked at him and I knew he was telling me goodbye. Well, he left the yard, but he came over and told me goodbye.
That was a very emotional moment for me. I didn't know what was coming. I had no idea. It was about, a month later, I learned that the husband and one of the children in the family were still living in the house, and they were wanting to sell some of the things because they were leaving the house. They had divorced, the mother and father had, and there was a lot of anger and a lot of resentment. And the husband came over, and I knew the family, that he was having some tough times, so we bought a couple of things from him, and that's when I learned what happened to Baron. Apparently, shortly after Baron had come over to say goodbye to me, he had been picked up by the Humane Society. The father of the family had grieved a great deal over this because he couldn't take Baron with him. Now, Baron was not that old a dog, and shepherds are known to live to be 9 years, sometimes older. So he was about 7, somewhere in there. And he said, I'd called the Humane Society so that Baron could be taken and could be put down. And he said, Baron never, ever went anywhere with anybody unless he was instructed to do so. So it really had been the husband's dog. But this dog had been very dedicated to the family. And he said, when the Humane Society truck pulled up, they had a ramp because Baron was a big dog. And the father was going to put the lead on Baron, and Baron didn't wait for him. Baron went up that ramp and in to the humane vehicle. So it really, really deeply affected the father because he knew that his dog knew that he was going to be put to sleep and was ready to go. When I heard that story, a lot of things fell into place for me. It made me aware many years ago of how animals do communicate with us and how important it is for us to listen, for us to pay attention. And I've had so many different unique experiences through the years, and I look at it, but the one with Baron really, really was a very meaningful one for me. So I wanted to be sure to share that with you, because we need to know that these are sentient beings, and they have so much to give us and so much to teach us. And Baron was a teacher in his own way for me, letting me know that my talents could be utilized in ways that I could never have imagined. This is Donna Sebo, and I know we're coming close to the end of our time for this program, but I feel that talking about animals is so important. We're hearing more and more stories about whales in the ocean, recognizing when people want to help them. We're coming across so many details about the different life forms that if we're willing to pay attention and understand they're not evil, they are a part of consciousness, a part of life. It really makes everything so much different in its presence. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Remember that what you do, how you think, how you feel, affects others around you, including those animals that you love. Ah, yes, they pick up on a lot of things. You don't think they do? You'll find if you are paying attention, they really do know what's happening with you, sometimes even before you do. That is why dogs and different animals are being trained to detect certain things with humans. Illnesses, you know, seizures of different types, all kinds of things. They let us know. God bless, be well, we'll be talking again soon, and yes, I'm on the road, but as I said before, the show goes on. Bye for now. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.